you, and thank you all for coming so early this morning. I kind of give myself away as a Washington lawyer for the suit. Let me start, before just going into this, I just want to answer to your question. There is a practical consequence beyond what Jennifer already described. I'm currently working with a client in Mexico, which is having significant difficulties negotiating an ABS agreement with the government. And we've been thrown all over the place in Mexico from one agency to another. Recently, we reached out to the State Department asking whether it could provide some assistance. And essentially, we were told it cannot because it's not a party to the Nagoya Protocol. And therefore, not being a party to the protocol, even though it's, to be sure, signed the convention, puts it in a much weaker position to influence parties about their own implementation of the protocol. So it's something of it's certainly something of an issue, and you're wise to raise it. If this gentleman, you had another question on this subject, we could take that now, if that's okay.
My question was related primarily to the idea that USDA provides limited funding for exploratory missions to collect germ plasm from other countries. And let's say I got a grant to do this.
Right.
How would that collection, and how would that work in terms of interacting with the local governments and the local people in the science that I would be working with to collect germ plasm in a way? And how would these protocols influence, or what processes?
It's a great question, and it's actually it's almost set up for me, that question, which is exactly what the question was. How does this work at the national, local, and community level? I think the lesson here, and which I'll get to, is that the protocol really should not be viewed necessarily as an international agreement as much as an agreement that requires countries to adopt legislation that imposes requirements governing access and benefit sharing. So each country that you've and Barbara showed the map that's now currently ratifying the protocol is either in the context of implementing the protocol, adopting regulations that govern how you and your scientists in foreign countries would go and collect material and what kind of benefits you need to share with either the government or, for that matter, with local indigenous communities that may have jurisdiction over those resources. And you'll see there's another layer of complexity. Well, there are a number of layers of complexity, but I think the short answer to your question is that each country is going to have its own specific set of requirements that it adopts as part of its implementation of the protocol. And what you end up having to do is work with people like me and work with local lawyers and other organizations in the source country and in an effort to sort of navigate the proper sort of processes to get the appropriate approvals. So let me, with that, just give you my message, which kind of follows from this. At least in my view, is sort of an increasingly kind of complex mosaic of different laws at different levels. You've got an international framework. You're going to see that there are various regional agreements. And then there are domestic requirements and even requirements at the local community level that will govern access to genetic resources and, for that matter, access to what's called traditional knowledge, which is also another entity that's recognized both in the Biological Diversity Convention that Barbara introduced as well as the protocol. So it's going to be very important for anyone collecting in a foreign country to understand what the law is on every level and dimension. Second, you need to understand exactly what you're taking. What resources are you taking and what agreements are they subject to? And you have to also have to, I think, understand exactly what you want to do. Are you carrying out research? Are you engaging in commercial activities? And where's the line between research and commercial activities? If you file a patent on a discovery, does that constitute commercial research or commercialization, or does that constitute some scientific research, or is it somewhere in between? So you need to understand that. The risk of enforcement out there and reputational harm to big companies and small is quite substantial. And that's not just because the government view this as its own property, but also because there are a number of non-governmental organizations that very, very, very closely follow these issues. Fourth, you should, I think, to the extent that you have the resources, have policies and procedures in place that ensure that those with whom you work, even at the local level, and they may be maybe foreign organizations or institutions properly collect under their own domestic laws. If you're working with universities, you should ensure that they're doing the right thing. If you have suppliers and vendors, you want to be sure that you have procedures or processes in place that ensure that they've properly collected under these agreements and so on. And then finally, if there's any doubt, I would urge you to establish an ABS agreement. Any doubt about the application of any of these laws, I urge you to establish an ABS agreement. As difficult as that may be, you ultimately, I think, will see that you protect the investment you make in the research or commercial activities you're pursuing. So I'm going to just very quickly go through this because Barb already laid out the framework, and I think Jennifer will also talk about the plant treaty. I think the first thing to understand is where the Nagoya Protocol and the Biological Diversity Convention apply to your activities and where the plant treaty applies, because they're essentially separate channels of regulation. And that's because Article 4.4 of the Nagoya Protocol essentially says that if there's already an international agreement set up to cover ABS, then that international agreement, to the extent that it's consistent with the Nagoya Protocol, will govern your collection and benefit sharing activities. So the plant treaty, as I think everyone here knows, and again, I'm not going to spend much time on it because I think Jennifer will, has various provisions that set up a system for access and benefit sharing for certain species. And those are crops that are covered in Annex 1 to that agreement. So if you're involved in research involving a crop that's in Annex 1 of the plant treaty, and you're in a country that has ratified the plant treaty, I think generally you can say that the plant treaty is going to govern your ABS requirements. And there, the plant treaty is relatively straightforward. Baked in to the international agreement is what's called an SMTA, or Standard Material Transfer Agreement, that prescribes exactly how resources should be exchanged and what kind of royalty rates and the like apply. So if you're in this world for the research you're doing, I think you're pretty well off. You should weigh in later, but I think, relatively speaking, you're pretty well off. If you're in this world, you're into the world of relative uncertainty. I mean, the CBD, as Barbara already explained, has these different purposes. And there was something of a quid pro quo. When countries agree to conserve their biological resources and to use them for sustainable use, that was sort of a concession they made. So in response to that, what they got was sovereignty over their resources and the right to require prior informed consent for utilization of the resources and benefit sharing in connection with any use that results in either commercial or even non-commercial benefits. Barb mentioned that wasn't enough. The parties, 10 years after they adopted the Biodiversity Convention, adopted these voluntary set of guidelines called the Barn Guidelines, but they really didn't do enough of the job. So the protocol was adopted a couple of years ago, entered into force in October of 2014, right? And it has essentially various types of obligations. But again, these are obligations that are imposed on parties that have signed and ratified the protocol. So there are access obligations where the country that's ratified the protocol is urged to adopt legislation that establishes procedures so that it can obtain prior informed consent from you before you undertake research in the country. If you do get that consent and you do use those resources, the protocol provides that you must engage in what it refers to as fair and equitable benefit sharing. It explicitly recognizes the rights of indigenous and local communities to participate in both conferring consent and benefit sharing, where those communities are either have jurisdiction over genetic resources, or you're using or arguably using traditional knowledge that belongs to the community. There's various kinds of other provisions that go to compliance. The protocol, as Barb mentioned, was meant to make the whole process more transparent, make it work. So it has countries designate what are called national focal points, which are supposed to be individuals in the country whom you approach with questions about how do I do this, and competent national authorities, which are meant to be the agencies that have principal or primary jurisdiction over particular resources in the country. And as Barb mentioned, there's an ABS clearinghouse, although it's in a nascent state. It's really just getting started. So as I was alluding to earlier, this is a really, I think, a completely sort of a complex mosaic, and I'll tell you why. As Barb mentioned, a number of countries 20 years ago, or more than 20 years ago, signed and ratified the convention. And that convention had its own access and benefit sharing provisions. So a number of countries, even 20 years ago, adopted some legislation to implement the access and benefit sharing provisions that were required, that for which it was authorized under the CBD. And then 20 years passed, and you've got countries that, 92, I think, at this point, that have signed the protocol, 62, or maybe it's now 64, that have ratified the protocol. And then how many that have of those that have ratified, how many have implemented? It's less than 14. So you have this mosaic where the original ABS requirements were applied 20 years ago, and countries are in varying, each country is in a different stage of implementation. Some countries have never ratified the protocol. They may not have even signed it, and yet they have legislation going to ABS requirements as a result of their ratification of the CBD. So each country, I think, when you go into a country and you're engaged in research, it's important to understand what the domestic law is and the extent to which that domestic law implements these provisions. To be sure, with adoption and ratification now of the protocol, countries that even those that haven't yet implemented the protocol are looking back at the legislation they adopted when the CBD came into force 20 years ago and now reshaping it. So what that ends up creating is this uncertainty. I mean, I mentioned Mexico. Mexico adopted some laws many, many years ago when it implemented the CBD. It's now going through a process of ratified the protocol, and it's now implementing those provisions. And there's all this uncertainty about which law applies, the new law, the old law, something in between. And essentially, Mexico's taken the position that until it now implements new legislation that ratifies or implements the protocol, it's essentially going to be closed for business. So, and I think that's going to be common in a number of countries. So adding to this layer of complexity, I'm going to be very quick, is our number of regional agreements out there that kind of recognize that genetic resources don't observe geopolitical boundaries. And all of these different types of regional agreements essentially call for harmony across those geopolitical borders. So you've got the Andean Pact, which obviously applies to the Andes. You've got this draft framework agreement for Asia. Africa has developed model legislation. Same thing in Central America. And then relatively recently, maybe a year or so ago, Europe adopted a regulation that covers the EU for all the countries that are members of that region. All right, so those are the access and benefit sharing provisions. On top of that, there are agreements that govern how one interacts with indigenous and local communities. Convention 169, which is under the ILO, or International Labor Organization, prescribes procedures for how you engage properly with indigenous people. Currently, there are negotiations going on in Geneva and elsewhere on a draft agreement under the World Intellectual Property Organization that would go to protection of folklore and traditional knowledge. There are various kinds of efforts within the context of both TRIPS and the WIPO that would call for disclosure of a mandatory disclosure of origin requirement in any patent law for a member of TRIPS or the WIPO. And then at the national level, various countries have themselves adopted disclosure of origin requirements, meaning you file a patent application, you need to disclose the origin of the materials that are the basis of that application. So Barbara mentioned that there are a number of terms that are defined in the protocol as well as the CBD. And yet, to sort of my theme of relative uncertainty, they're either very broadly defined or they're not defined at all. And they're ultimately subject to the whim and to the sort of discretion of a government agency that's implementing the protocol through its own legislation. So these are the terms that are defined, and these are the terms that are not defined. They're all extremely important terms for anyone trying to access material in a foreign country, and yet they're either so broadly defined or not defined at all that you have to kind of navigate your way through the maze. Outside of that complexity, there's also some, are there also questions about how do you, you know, what activities are subject to the protocol and particular provisions? For example, I alluded to it earlier, what is scientific research and when does it cross the line to commercial use? When you file a patent application, is that research or is it only when the patent is issued that it becomes commercial activity? If you collected material prior to adoption of the Nagoya Protocol, is that subject to the ABS provisions that apply after the protocol entered into force? Some countries would say, as Europe did when it adopted its implementing regulation, no, it's only that which is collected and accessed afterwards. But a number of other countries, including India and Brazil, take the position that if you collected it after the Biodiversity Convention and its ABS provisions were adopted, you're subject to our ABS requirements, including benefit sharing. So there are all kinds of questions around the timing of application of these requirements. From whom do you need consent? Which government agencies? What indigenous and local communities have jurisdiction over resources? And then finally, if you, let's say, do an ABS agreement on research, and which is fine, and that's frequently done, and it's a relatively simple agreement, and then you decide you want to commercialize, what kind of so-called change of intent with respect to those resources is necessary? So, for example, let's say you go out and collect seed in a particular country, and the seed is just sitting there. You don't need to go back and collect it, but you want to use it for a different purpose. What kind of procedures do you need to engage in with respect to changing your intent for the utilization of those materials? I'm going to keep going because I think I'm close. Anyway, I alluded to this. There are all kinds of stakeholders and decision makers that need to be carefully sort of worked with. And that's because the government is very, very, you know, foreign governments believe this is their property. And if you go in and take their property without proper permission, you're the subject of potentially criminal sanctions. So Brazil, a couple of years ago, threatened to fine companies something like $44 million for allegedly violating that state's or that country's laws. In India, it's been threatening to bring legal action against Monsanto now for many, many years. South Africa, and I was involved for disclosure purposes representing Nestle in this matter, claimed that Nestle had hired a collector that improperly took materials out of the country and sent them to Europe for review and research. Mexico has brought, as I alluded to earlier, a number of actions. And Kenya, in a relatively famous case, brought actions against U.S. universities for its research on microorganisms and thermophiles that were ultimately, I think, used in Thai to bleach genes. So one of the lessons here is that foreign governments very, very vigorously enforce these requirements, and they do so even though they don't have necessarily all the legislation in place. And then compounding that is that non-governmental organizations very, very closely monitor what you and I and our clients are doing. So, for example, in the Nestle matter, that came to light because there's an organization in Switzerland called the Bern Declaration, which is an NGO that follows these activities. They follow the patent filings by Nestle, and they noticed that one of those patent filings mentioned reliance on a particular plant coming from South Africa. So the Bern Declaration reached out to its contacts in South Africa, went to the government, discovered that the supplier to Nestle had not properly obtained permission to take those materials and ship them to Europe. And the next thing you know, on the front page of the International Herald Tribune is this report that Nestle's engaged in biopiracy. And to the earlier discussion we had, the U.S. is not, I don't think, in as strong as a position as it could be to help, because it's not a party. It's not really a party to the Biodiversity Convention. Yes, it's signed, but it's not ratified. And it's certainly not a party to the Nagoya Protocol. So to the extent that you can actually get the U.S. in the first place to intervene, you know, foreign governments are going to say, where are you? You haven't even ratified the protocol. Why are you coming to me now and complaining about it? So I think one of the lessons, which is to not get yourself into trouble and to ensure that you're properly collecting materials. And I alluded to it earlier, but that means you need to understand all of the laws and regulations, what your research partners are doing, if you're working with suppliers, vendors, or universities, what kind of activities they're engaged in with respect to your research, and also what, to the Nestle example, what your foreign partners are doing. You've got to, I think increasingly you're going to have to deal with these disclosure of origin requirements in patent filings. You want to be sure those don't come back to haunt you. And to the extent that you publish research, you know, articles, I think the standard best practice now is to the extent that you got the resources, the genetic resources, or for that matter, the traditional knowledge that form the basis of those publications, you should attribute that, you know, that the source of those materials came from a particular country or a particular community. And where there's any doubt whatsoever, try to do an ABS agreement, as difficult as this landscape is, because otherwise the downside of not doing so is really quite extreme. What does an ABS agreement look like? Generally, it has these provisions, and we've done these with a number of different companies in several countries. There's always some preambular statement about the importance of Nagoya and the CBD and the indigenous and local community agreements. You want to very clearly define, you know, what the purposes of the agreement are and what its purposes are. Usually, it's, you know, you're going to have a provision that deals with prior informed consent for use of genetic resources. If traditional knowledge is involved, there'll be an article that goes to that issue as well. And Barbara referred to this, but benefits kind of break down into non-monetary benefits and monetary benefits. On the non-monetary side, that's things like working with local research institutions. If you're working in communities, working with farmers, help and engaging them and helping you conduct your research or your commercial activities. On the monetary side, usually that's done through the creation of trusts. So let's say you develop a product, it creates revenue. You're going to end up through the sort of equitable sharing of monetary benefits, funneling money into a trust that in turn distributes those funds to the relevant parties. Australia has done that. South Africa has done that. I think Brazil, which recently adopted a new law, contemplates establishment of a trust for the distribution of benefits. I mean, obviously, any ABS agreement needs to deal with the rights to intellectual property rights. What kind of rights do you have to samples that you collect? How confidential is all of this? What is confidentiality in a foreign environment? And what kind of reports do you have to make? There's always going to be a reporting requirement. The only question is how often, with what frequency, and what kind of confidentiality. Let's say you have a company and you want to sell it to a larger entity. You know, what kind of engagement with the government do you need to pursue before doing so? Do you need their permission? Can you simply just provide notice? And then there's always the usual, you know, contractual provisions and provisions that govern dispute resolution and the like. Anyway, I think I'm at my 20, yeah? So we can pick this up afterwards. Okay. Thank you. And I should say, I can leave this here, but I do have an